judges. I ride.
When the rich take absolute power, then the citizens become disposable, which is in essence what's happened.
The meme of you can do anything to the terrorist, and then dissent becomes like if you're a protester, you're a terrorist. You're seeing that in democracies around the world. So this is definitely a blueprint that's now global.
From somebody else. And as we go,
you're listening to episode 703 of Unwelcome Guests, Dispatches from Weimar, America. I'm Robin Upton. And we've just heard a quick summary from Chris Hedges and Naomi Wolf, very broad brush outline. We're looking this time at a range of details, just how complete is the surveillance grid being rolled out from America and worldwide, why is it being rolled out, and what to do about it. As usual, a range of contrasting opinions and reflections, and we conclude the show this time with a look at the strange case of Philip Marshall. Now we begin the show with an interview. This is from Russia Today, of a regular contributor to the show, and this is from earlier this year.
Earlier this month, New York University professor Mark Crispin Miller released a list of five historical books that have been actively suppressed and hidden from Americans. These books focus on issues from abortion to financial inequality and tell stories of an America that don't conform to the mainstream narrative we've all been taught. To discuss further, I'm joined by New York University Media Studies professor Mark Crispin Miller himself. Thank you so much for coming on, Mark.
Oh, it's good to be back, Abby. Thank you.
So, Mark, outline some institutionalized ways that literature is routinely censored in this country.
Well, as you pointed out in your introduction, we don't ban books. The First Amendment prohibits it. But there's more than one way to skin a cat. And in fact, hundreds of books on crucial subjects, indispensable books, books full of truths that Americans really ought to know, have been undone in one way or another. Threats of litigation, for example, by powerful interests. Reviewers freezing out certain titles, or what happens most often is books are written off as conspiracy theory. What we're doing, I want to make clear, it isn't just listing five of these books, which we will talk about in a moment. Those are the first five books in a new series called Forbidden Bookshelf, whose purpose is to make important works that are now out of print available again. And the great majority of these books were indeed deliberately done in by powerful interests, by the CIA, by corporate powers, and so on. We're taking advantage of the digital revolution to do a dozen books a year. We're doing e-books so that Americans can finally get hold of these crucial writings.
And Mark, why did you choose these five books for the first of the series? What common historical threads do they share?
Well, you know, it was an embarrassment of riches, but I guess you could say that we picked the first five because they offered a very interesting range of different concerns, and also because I'd say four out of the five really speak to the moment we're living in right now. First of all, there's the Phoenix Program by Douglas Valentine. This came out in the early 90s. It's an absolutely crucial and harrowing study of an enormous CIA covert program that took place in South Vietnam during the war there. It was basically a terror program whose purpose was to combine the forces of the military and the police and intelligence and basically pacify the South Vietnamese population and keep them quiet, basically enforce the rule of the South Vietnamese regime, all in the name of fighting terror. Now, in his new introduction to this book, Doug Valentine points out that the Phoenix Program could be regarded as a kind of template for our war on terror here in the United States, that increasingly we're losing our civil liberties bit by bit. So the government uses the danger of terrorism to justify all kinds of horrible infringements, you know, on our constitutional rights. So that it's now okay, for example, to assassinate American citizens with drones. It's now okay to subject American citizens to indefinite detention by the military. all of this was first put into practice by the CIA in Vietnam through the Phoenix program, which accounts for the deaths of tens of thousands of civilians in South Vietnam who were tortured and assassinated. This is a book that, as I say, speaks to today.
I wanted to jump in here really quick and read a quote from that author's new introduction because it's so damning. He claims the Phoenix has already landed in America, of course, saying, "Take heed, reader. Phoenix has come to define modern American warfare as well as its internal homeland security apparatus. Indeed, it's with the Phoenix program that we find the genesis of the paramilitarization of American police forces in their role as adjuncts to the military and political security forces engaged in population control and suppression of dissent." Mark, it's amazing that I didn't even know about the Phoenix program. I know a lot about covert CIA operations. I mean, it's incredible that this really apparently did provide this blueprint for the ongoing war on terror. Can you speak more to that?
Well, yeah, and the fact that you don't know about the program basically means that you don't know about the book, and you don't know about the book because the book was marginalized, ignored, and so on. Doug Valentine had a lot of trouble. I mean, initially, he got the go-ahead from William Colby, the head of the CIA, who was the most prominent defender of the program before Congress. And on that basis, Valentine talked to a lot of CIA officers who'd been involved in the program. So it's very, very solid in a scholarly way, very well documented. But it was it became clear to the agency after a couple of years that they did not want this guy to be doing this research. So they immediately clammed up, and he had to go to war with them legally. The ACLU helped him. But then what happened when the book came out is that Morley Safer of CBS wrote a very damning review for the New York Times. Whether he did this at the behest of the agency or not, we don't know. But in either case, it basically meant the end of Doug Valentine's career as a writer who would have a major publisher do his books. He was basically blacklisted in an informal way. So we're trying to rectify that great wrong and help Americans rediscover some crucial information about our recent past by bringing the book out again on the forbidden bookshelf.
Absolutely. We keep seeing these stories repeated time and time again, Mark. Another book, Lords of Creation, written by Frederick Lewis Allen, going for about $2,500 a pop for a new print copy on Amazon. Why is this book such a forbidden treasure?
Yeah, The Lords of Creation is written by Frederick Lewis Allen, who was a very popular writer in his day. And all of his other popular histories were in print. This one book was not in print, The Lords of Creation, which is a really highly readable account, basically, of the early history of the 1%. It starts with J.P. Morgan's creation of U.S. Steel and takes us through the history of how these buccaneering financiers have basically subjected America to repeated booms and busts and always enriched themselves in the process. The edition in Forbidden Bookshelf has a new introduction by Gretchen Morgenson of the New York Times, who really hits the nail on the head when she says that this history will help us understand where we are today and recognize that what we're going through now economically has deep roots going on for a long time.
Mark, another better-known operation than the Phoenix program is Operation Paperclip, of course, outlined in Christopher Simpson's book, Blowback. It's not necessarily the story that I wanted to talk about. It's his new introduction in this ebook. It's particularly fascinating to me because it outlines overt censorship that he encountered as an archivist when trying to issue a written critique about the government's declassification process. Can you briefly describe the story and why it reveals, or what it reveals rather, about the way the government archives its own hidden history?
That's right. He was part of an advisory group of historians who was supposed to help the government assess its own efforts at declassification, specifically of documents having to do with our involvement with Nazis and fascists after the war. And he wrote a little piece that was supposed to be published in a larger collection, a piece that was strongly critical of the declassification program and took issue specifically with the attempt to appoint John Yoo. You remember that name?
Oh, yeah.
John Yoo, the notorious attorney who sought to justify the Bush regime's torture program. They tried to put him at the helm of the National Archives. Now, there was a fuss over this, and cooler heads prevailed, But the interesting thing is that Christopher Simpson's piece about this, which he submitted to the National Archive for publication in their report, was itself censored. They left it out of the report. So it's now part of the new introduction to Christopher Simpson's Blowback, which is the first, and I think by far the best, history of U.S. recruitment of Nazis and fascists after World War II for help in the Cold War.
Certainly tells a different story than what we've been told about World War II and the defeat of Nazi Germany, Mark. I have to say, in the introduction to this series, you write an excellent introduction to the five books on ebooks, that once these books are gone out of print, they're gone forever. Is that really true, though? Because I was able to find these books in full on Amazon. I mean, what's the big deal with not having hard copies, Mark, when the advent of the internet's making books obsolete anyways?
Well, don't forget, we are publishing ebooks, so, you know, we're not actually offering hard copies. I actually wish we were, because I'm a kind of diehard fan of actual books. Nevertheless, your point is well taken, which is why we're doing these as ebooks. Many of them are available in used editions online, but the fact is that when you publish a book properly, that's a way of introducing it to the world, you know? If you go to look for a particular volume to buy it used on Amazon, that suggests to me that you already know that it exists.
Right.
You see my point? Whereas what we're doing is we're republishing them. We're making the world aware that they exist. And, crucially, we're offering them with new introductions to bring them up to date. We got a lot more books coming out in the next few months and in the years to come. We're going to be doing I.F. Stone's Hidden History of the Korean War. We're also going to be doing Stone's Underground to Palestine, along with all of his other writings on Israel and Palestine. We're going to be doing Gerard Colby's DuPont Dynasty, Behind the Nylon Curtain. This is an amazing history of the DuPont Dynasty, that the DuPont Corporation itself managed to kill twice, both in the 70s and 80s. We're bringing that out with a new introduction.
Mark, I have to tell you that, I mean, I was so fascinated just reading the books that you sent me. I cannot wait to dig more into this really hidden history here that everyone needs to check out. Thank you so much, Mark Crispin Miller. Amazing project. Everyone get involved.
Now, thanks to Maria Galadin of TUC Radio, who provided the next interview. This is with Professor Alfred McCoy. It's an interview about an article he wrote in 2013.
University of Madison, Wisconsin, Professor of History, Alfred McCoy, credits Edward Snowden for having revealed today's reality. And McCoy adds his perspective of the intriguing history that led up to this point. And he makes a few predictions as to what to expect in the near future. That article in Tom Dispatch caught the attention of radio host and writer Jeff Blankford. He allowed me to broadcast the highlights of his interview with Professor McCoy. McCoy studied Southeast Asian history at Yale before coming to Madison. In 1971, he wrote a book on the opium trade in Laos and discovered that the French financed their covert operations from the control of the Indochina drug trade. He also found evidence that after the U.S. replaced the French, the CIA took over the drug trade. He is radio host of Takes on the World, Jeff Blankford, with his first question.
You've traced more than a century of U.S. surveillance strategies from what we would now consider primitive to high tech. What impact, if any, do you think Snowden's revelations will have on the course of Washington's future surveillance strategies?
Over 100 years ago, Mark Twain put forward a very simple proposition when he wrote about the U.S. conquest and colonization of the Philippines. He said that by trampling on the rights of the helpless abroad, the American people learned the apathy to endure the like at home. In short, Twain argued that we couldn't have empire abroad and democracy at home. And now that Edward Snowden has revealed to us the incredible extent of NSA surveillance that the NSA, the National Security Agency, has effectively established an American domestic surveillance state, and indeed is working hard to build a global surveillance apparatus. So the question has been called.
What was interesting was that initially after the revelations, the polls that I heard seemed to think that most Americans were apathetic, as Mark Twain had predicted, that there was not the outrage by a large segment of the public about what the government was doing. If you're not doing anything wrong, why worry about it? And we've seen this kind of atmosphere. We had church hearings back in the 70s, which was an attempt to actually change, to get rid of COINTELPRO, some of the surveillance and counterintelligence techniques and operations the government was using. But we don't seem to have any significant numbers of members of Congress. We don't really see that kind of anger against this that we saw back in the 70s, and the mainstream media seems more preoccupied with talking about Edward Snowden and where he's going to go and whether he's a criminal or not than actually what the revelations were.
I think the difference between the 70s and now is that back in the 1970s, it was revealed that during our involvement in the Vietnam War, the FBI and the CIA were conducting massive counterintelligence and surveillance of the anti-war protesters, which represented a significant segment of American society. They were essentially the baby boom generation, the biggest generation in American history. And in 1974, the famous investigative reporter Seymour Hersh published an article in the New York Times saying that the CIA was running an illegal operation, Operation Chaos, that in violation of the CIA's charter, was conducting domestic surveillance of the anti-war protest movement here in the United States. That led, of course, as you mentioned, Senator Frank Church's very famous investigative committee, the Church Committee, to look into both Operation Chaos by the CIA and then the FBI's long-running counterintelligence program, discovering that, first of all, that the CIA's operation, which had a database, computer database with about 300,000 names in it, was completely illegal. And that, second, that the FBI's counterintelligence operations were using illegal tactics that were a violation of democratic principles to harass both the African-American civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam protest movement. And because these were both significant sectors of American society, African-Americans, about 12 to 13% of all the American people, and the protesters were a very large baby boom generation, Congress acted, and what they did was they ratcheted back the establishment of a permanent surveillance state by creating the so-called FISA courts, requiring that any time a government agency wanted to do wiretapping inside the United States, they had to get a warrant from this special FISA court. So that represented a kind of substantial reform. And that was a continuation of a pattern that actually we've seen in the United States operating from the 1890s, if I could just place that in context, okay? And then come to the present and show what's changed and why we're in a very different circumstance and why Snowden's revelations are so important. That, look, the origins of the U.S. surveillance capacity, the capacity of the federal government to conduct surveillance of American citizens, dates back to the late 19th century. The United States came up with a synergy of brilliant innovations in data management. But the federal government, because of Constitution and the courts, had really no enforcement capacity beyond the customs barrier. And so when we intervened in the Philippines in 1898, we were suddenly in very new terrain. The U.S. Army, which plunged into the pacification of a dense, hostile Asian society that had just conducted two generations of political mobilization and launched the first national revolution in Asia that had defeated 300 years of Spanish colonial rule. And we were faced with the pacification of this insurgent republic. We had a very powerful army. We could smash anything, but we didn't know where to strike or how to strike. And so the U.S. Army created, in 1901, the first field intelligence unit in its 100-year history. And it placed in charge of that unit a man named Captain Ralph Van Diemen. He developed very sophisticated counterintelligence techniques. He did a kind of map of the entire Philippine political elite, collecting amazingly detailed data on thousands of Filipino political leaders. And then the U.S. Army Signal Corps laced the archipelago with 10,000 miles of telegraph wires, allowing for the instantaneous transmission of this sophisticated intelligence data. Moreover, the first U.S. colonial governor of the Philippines, William Howard Taft, created a colonial police force called the Philippines Constabulary that applied these very sophisticated counterintelligence penetration techniques to pacifying the Philippines. So by 1907, the combination of the army's intelligence and this colonial police had pacified the country. Well, 10 years later, the United States joined World War I, and we were the only army on either side of the battle lines in World War I that didn't have an intelligence service of any description. So the U.S. Army, in April 1917, established the Military Intelligence Division, and they appointed Captain, now Colonel Ralph Van Diemen, to be the founder of U.S. Army Military Intelligence, indeed U.S. Internal Security. And he applied his Philippine experience, his rich, detailed Philippine experience, to constructing a counterintelligence apparatus in the United States. And very quickly, Military Intelligence Division grew from one employee himself to 1,700. And then he worked with the FBI, which had been recently established. And together they formed an alliance with a civilian group called the American Protective League, which had 350,000 badge-carrying civilian agents, counterintelligence agents. And they conducted the most massive surveillance of any society to date in human history. And after the war was over, the FBI and military intelligence, working with its kind of citizen vigilantes, conducted the notorious Luster raids in New York City, the Palmer raids across the northeastern United States, and they smashed strikes by the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies, from New York Harbor all the way to Seattle. And the abuses were so extraordinary that when Republicans came into power in 1921, because all this had been done under a liberal Democratic president, Woodrow Wilson. So when the Republicans came into power, they were concerned about privacy. The Republican Attorney General, Harlan Fisk Stone, in 1924 said that a secret police is a potential danger to a free society, and he forced the FBI to cut all of its ties to citizen vigilante groups. And he proclaimed that the FBI was no longer interested in the political beliefs of any American, whatever they might be. And famously, 5 years later, in 1929, a Republican who was serving as Secretary of War, Henry L. Stimson, abolished the cipher, the kind of code-breaking section of the Military Intelligence Division, saying, "Gentlemen, do not read each other's mail." Okay, so what we saw is a pattern established. In time of war, internal security expanded. When peacetime comes, through the partisan process, the opposite party cuts back on the surveillance apparatus radically, sharply, preventing the establishment of a standing or permanent surveillance state. That's the same pattern we saw during the Vietnam era. Massive expansion in internal surveillance by FBI and CIA during the 1960s, the era of the Vietnam protests, particularly under Republican conservative President Richard Nixon. But then in the 1970s, as the Vietnam War came to an end, Democrats, the opposite party, in a partisan process, ratchet back the surveillance state. Now, that pattern continued. Right after 9/11, President Bush illegally allowed the National Security Agency, the NSA, to start conducting systematic surveillance of Americans. They decided that metadata, the kind of stuff at the top of your email message, was not constitutionally protected, and therefore they allowed the NSA to start collecting metadata of all emails. The FBI built very quickly something called the Investigative Data Warehouse that had over 1 billion messages in it within 5 years. This was pretty systematic surveillance, okay? It was exposed by the New York Times in 2005. It was exposed by USA Today in an important investigative article in 2006. So when President Obama came into office, he was fully aware of the extent and the abuse, the illegality of things that have been done under President Bush, but he broke the partisan pattern. Instead of cutting back on the surveillance that was done under his Republican predecessor, Obama has decided to make cyber surveillance and cyber warfare the centerpiece of a new defense posture. And so he's built upon the Bush surveillance, and he's begun building through the NSA a global surveillance apparatus, which is a kind of agile, low-cost vehicle for the perpetuation of U.S. global hegemony.
What you have described in this article, as I say, going back to the Philippines and the development of new technologies that enabled the surveillance state to begin. It's a very scary scenario, and even though whatever Congress seems to do, there seems to be a limit on what they will be allowed to even know.
Right. You said it's a frightening scenario, but I don't think it's overstated. 4 years ago, also writing in Time Dispatch, drawing upon my book, Policing America's Empire, I said, look, let's look at the long trajectory of U.S. history. Look at this pattern I just described of expansion of surveillance during wartime, and then when the rival party comes back into power after the war is over, ratcheting back on the surveillance apparatus. Okay, and in 2009, I said, okay, it was the start of the Obama administration. Back in 2009, I said, we are just a few tweaks away from developing a domestic surveillance state in the United States. I said, you know, we're almost there. It could happen.
And you were right.
I was right. In other words, and historians actually, I think, have a terrible track record in using history, you know, using the past to predict the future. But, you know, if you do it right, if you look at the sort of trajectory, the overarching trajectory, not the details, nobody can do that, you can see trends, and you can see the shape of the trends and where we're heading, right? That allows you to sort through all the kind of noise of the daily press, all the sensationalism, you know, all the usual stuff that we get in our media. And this larger history that I just described to you, that allows us to see the trajectory. And I think now that if you look at the situation we're in, that Congress's capacity to cut this back, I think, is fairly limited. Let me explain. In 2012, when President Obama came out with his defense budget, this was a point where he'd been in office long enough where he understood things, where he could really begin to take control. He could see the shape of the future. All right, and as we all know, many of the attributes of U.S. global power that have existed for the past 50 years are beginning to wane. You know, back in 1950, we had something like half of world trade under our control. You know, China is on the edge of passing us as the world's number one economic power. The World Bank predicts by 2016, China will have about 18% of world trade, and we'll have just 17%. We'll become the number two world power, okay? So clearly, although our absolute economic strength is still quite impressive, relatively, we presided over an era, a half century, of global growth. It's a compliment to U.S. global power, okay, that we've been able to do this. Well, nonetheless, our relative power is waning. So how do we maintain our world leadership? President Obama has cut back in his 2012 defense budget infantry by 14%. He's cutting back on all the conventional heavy metal weaponry, the aircraft, the tanks, the trucks, the destroyers, the cruisers, all the rest of it. And what he's doing is he's moving us, if you read his budget, into an era of cyber warfare and space warfare. And he's building a new agile global apparatus, low cost, for the perpetuation of U.S. global power. In 2009, Obama established the U.S. Cyber Command, which declared cyberspace to be a domain of military conflict, just like air, land, and sea. And he established the U.S. Cyber Command, and he appointed as the head of the U.S. Cyber Command General Keith Alexander, who's concurrently, of course, the head of the NSA, the man who's been walking around Congress yesterday lobbying intensely against the amendment by Representative Amash of Michigan, trying to stop Congress from cutting back NSA's right to unchecked surveillance. This is more power in the hands of a single man than anybody has ever had before. So look, the NSA, simultaneously under its very operations, working with its counterpart British intelligence, has begun tapping into fiber optic cables all across the United States. And then its counterpart agency in the UK, the Government Communications Headquarters, GCHQ, starting in 2011 in a project launched jointly with the NSA, sank 200 probes into the transatlantic cables and began harvesting 600 messages a month. In March of this year, the NSA is believed to have harvested 97 billion messages. That's over a trillion messages a year from the United States and around the world. The fiber optic cables, because all of our communications, telephone and email, all of our communications, text and voice, now go through these fiber optic cables. It's an amazing centralization of all human communication. So by sinking probes into just a few thousand cables, you can basically scoop up the world's communications, all right? That's what NSA is doing. Simultaneously, the Obama administration has created brand new headquarters, constructed at the cost of nearly $2 billion, for the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency that's monitoring all of the communications in the skies above. So it's kind of NSA tapping into the fiber optic cables in the ground below while the NGIA, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, is developing an apparatus to surveil all the communications in the skies above. The Obama administration has been building and launching a flotilla of 99 Global Hawk drones. Now, these are not like the Reapers and Predators that are armed with missiles that are really kind of combat-oriented. The Global Hawk is a surveillance drone that has continuous 20-hour flight and can take, very sharp images for a 100-mile radius and, more importantly for our purposes, suck up all audio communications, two-way radios, local cell phone towers, stuff that's going from a cell phone to a tower. It can scoop that up for a 100-mile radius. So we're developing a comprehensive apparatus. Simultaneously, the Air Force has launched the world's first space drone, the X-37B, which has been successfully tested since April 2010. And it can carry missiles to knock out any rival global telecommunication satellite system. Most of the U.S. military command, control, and communications goes through satellites. And we have had, for the better part of 60 years, the world a monopoly on satellite communications. We have the world's only global satellite system. China, by 2020, will have the world's second satellite system. And in 2007, China conducted an experiment. They shot a missile up and they knocked out one of their own orbiting satellites. So the age of space warfare has arrived. So the combination of NSA monitoring the fiber optic cables and the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, along with the Air Force, monitoring all surface communications means that we have built or are on the edge of completing the world's first truly global surveillance apparatus. We now are at a unique historical moment. Edward Snowden has put the issue on the front page of the paper. You know, those NSA slides that Washington Post has published, any American can go and look at those slides and see the scope and the scale of this domestic surveillance. And I think the ACLU is very well aware that this is not just passive. It's not just a question, well, we have nothing to hide. You know, my phone calls to my family, my visa bills, so what if they're monitoring that? Well, they're not worried about that. They're worried about deviance of any sort. And we've seen that the American state, like all states, has a tendency to consider any form of challenge to its authority to be deviance. I mean, we've seen the IRS has been monitoring or slowing the applications for the various Tea Party affiliates. We know that environmental activists are under fairly strict surveillance with their mail being monitored. All right, so basically anybody that is going to challenge, exercise their constitutional rights, and become an activist that's going to challenge the current dispensation anyway, faces the risk of harassment. This stuff is not benign. It's just not. It's used against anybody, left, center, or right, who's going to be in any way politically active. And it's that very small percentage of the population, all right, that are going to be subjected to the harassment and the power that this surveillance allows. Lest we forget, J. Edgar Hoover, all right, for 30 years, right, protected his bureau, the FBI, from any meaningful legislative or congressional oversight because Hoover had his private files where he had all of the financial and sexual derelictions of influential Americans on the file, and nobody dared challenge him. All right, so this stuff is never benign. All right, it's used selectively to target those that are politically active. And without these activists, okay, without people like Reverend Martin Luther King, who was, by the way, subject to intensive FBI surveillance and had lots of incriminating information collected about him, without people like Martin Luther King, you know, think about what King represented, the movement that he led, the change that made in the quality of American life, absolutely critical. Well, you know, government wasn't doing that by itself. It was a movement. Movements for change always are the way that the American people express their political will. But with this surveillance capacity, the state can actually cripple the capacity of the civil society and ordinary citizens to change the direction of their government. And the American state will not prosper. And if a society that stills dissent, okay, that stills critics, is a society that doesn't change, doesn't adapt, as all societies and their governments must do continuously. I would argue that using this apparatus, and it will be used, right, allowing this accretion of power, allowing this apparatus to exist, allowing it to operate without any functional oversight, and there is no oversight, there is a potential risk. As Harlan Fiske said back in 1924, a secret police is a potential threat to a free society. And that remains as true today as it was back in 1924.
Well, this interesting colonel, captain, colonel, finally Brigadier General von Dehmann would look back on what he has achieved with a big smile on his face. You say he is the father of military intelligence, and most Americans have never heard his name.
Right. And actually, he's also, interestingly enough, the father of the American blacklist, because as I explained, when the system he ran in the Philippines was used politically, all right, as I said, it's not benign. Under William Howard Taft and Captain Van Diemen, that intelligence apparatus did two things. First of all, it not only monitored the political activities of Filipinos in all discourse, in all public space, press, and public speech, okay, but it penetrated the homes. It collected all kinds of incriminating information about the two things, of course, that such incriminating information always has, sex, sexual peccadilloes, and financial malfeasance. Now, those that were sympathetic to the U.S. colonial regime found their peccadilloes buried within the files of the U.S. colonial security apparatus. Those who were critics of the U.S. colonial regime found their peccadilloes released to the press and their reputations destroyed. That's the way the system operates. That's the risk to any democracy, that massive amounts of information can be used against individual critics. Well, let's go back to Van Diemen. He retired as a major general from the U.S. Army in 1929. He retired to San Diego and bought himself a nice, comfortable bungalow. And he and his wife was quite a formidable woman. She was the first woman to ever fly on an aircraft. They set up a private intelligence service because, as I explained earlier, that during the 1920s, you know, Congress and the courts had cut back on the domestic surveillance apparatus. So Van Diemen filled that void, and he ran a kind of private exchange service of intelligence between the Red Squads in San Diego and Los Angeles, the city police, Office of Naval Intelligence, U.S. Army Military Intelligence, and then business associations had their own intelligence services. And he assembled all this information. He compiled dossiers on 250,000 Americans, particularly those in Hollywood suspected of subversion. And he served as an informal conduit, moving incriminating information from classified government files into the hands of anti-communist activists who would blacklist people. And it's believed, for example, in 1950, when Congresswoman Helen Gahagan Douglas ran against Congressman Richard Nixon for the Senate seat from the state of California, Van Diemen is believed in his files are believed to have been the source of the so-called pink sheets that Nixon circulated as rallies, or implying that Helen Gahagan Douglas was a communist or a communist sympathizer, that she was pink. And that, of course, played a critical role in Nixon's electoral victory in 1950, putting him on a path to presidency of the United States.
And we continue with Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief of Truth Dig, asking an important and direct question to Heidi Boghossian during a book discussion on her book, Spying on Democracy, from earlier this month.
So let me ask you about the legal community that you have a lot of contact with as the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild and so forth. Why are these people so out to lunch? Why is there not more outrage in this community?
In the community of progressive lawyers?
No, not progressive. Lawyers.
Lawyers.
They're supposed to believe in the rule of law. They're supposed to believe in limited government, the rights of the individual. Why are people asleep at the switch? Why do we have to lecture them about the evils of totalitarianism?
I think many lawyers and others are concerned. The government, the so-called unitary executive, has become so powerful that the George W. Bush administration's legal counsel wrote memos justifying torture. It was an immediately sort of played out on TV programs like 24, tortures become normalized. And I blame the corporate media for being a part of that because they dictate the realities, what we see. It's really all about control of information. It's about secrecy by government, and that includes not letting us see dead bodies coming back from Iraq, not seeing the damage and trauma that young American men who come back and women from the battlefields. It's about covering that up, and again, with corporations giving us a kind of propaganda, a message to make us more perfect consumers, but to also vilify the act of speaking out against such things, so that there may be angry voices saying that these things are wrong, but they don't get reported on in the media. When you see police with less lethal weapons attacking passive protesters or crowd, all you see are images of police in riot gear with kind of scruffy protesters. You'll hear about mass arrests, but it will be months or years before you hear that those arrests were unconstitutional, that surrounding people with netting for doing nothing wrong, then arresting them as they did with 700 occupiers on the Brooklyn Bridge, who the police led onto the roadway, took them through stoplights, letting the protesters feel they were allowed to go there, but then they arrested them all. I think that we have such a sort of singular one-way message from government and corporate played through the media that, and I tried to include some stories of little resistors, be it school children who refused to give a palm scan to get into their high school cafeteria for lunch. We don't hear about those stories. We're faced with an overwhelming amount of propaganda guised in the form of marketing and, as I mentioned earlier, brand loyalty to big business.
So, as they say on TV, the book is spying on democracy. And I let me ask you about the takeaway from this, because generally people say, okay, privacy, so what? My ex-wife or my ex-husband will know this. I can live with it. I like the convenience of shopping and not using a credit card and using my fingerprint, blah, 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 or scanning this, and so forth. What really you're talking about is the end of the democratic experiment. I mean, we're playing it down now. I don't know why for this discussion, but this is a very depressing book. I hate to say it, it's an informative book, but you're really talking about not, you know, giving up some of, you know, personal taste freedom and somebody will know this about me. We're talking about the totalitarian state, right?
Right.
Or am I putting words
in? No, we're talking about the totalitarian state.
I mean, basically the assumption of this book is that this thing protected in the Fourth Amendment of a space that's your own, where you can regroup, where you can meet with others, where you can exchange letters. Because, as Brandeis pointed out and others, it wasn't just in the home.
Right.
It was in your communication. It was wild thoughts while walking. It's personal space. And without that personal space for the individual, this whole idea of democracy, whether it's the Greek notion or whatever, it doesn't mean anything. Mm. You're in the crowd. You're observed at every moment. You have no time to think. You have no freedom to think, and so forth. And so the real message of your book is that this is a war on democracy. And,
yes.
And yet it's done in the name of protecting democracy. Well, that's always been the case. This was the rise of Nazism in Germany, is, you know, what Stalinism, what have you. It was always to protect some basic values and the right of the people. So again, I get back to the question, why is this not more alarming? Why do we sound like some oddball characters worried about this thing, knowing probably full well that when we get out of this meeting, we'll probably give away even more of our privacy, right? I mean, I'll probably look for some restaurant and give the information. I'll send an email that anyone can see, right? I'll make this phone call that can be tracked. Google can take a picture of my house and everything about it. I mean, come on. Why is this more alarming? And you suggest what I think is, I can't believe it's true, but maybe it's true, that we trust the state? No, I mean, no, because that is sort of the assumption. It'll only be done to the other. Now, this is a denial, as I said at the very beginning, of the whole assumption of our society, which is a constitutional society of restraint on the state. you know, restraint on power, built on suspicion of power, built on the need to protect individual right. And yet, as a culture, and maybe it's because of the dominance of, you know, the only way we think about freedom is consumer sovereignty, consumer freedom, and being free to be, you know, consumers, that we've lost that notion? Or what do we think it's only going to be, you know, Muslims of a certain kind that are going to be persecuted and we don't have to worry about it? What? Because you deal with, right, you're out there, you're mm-hmm. handling cases, you're dealing with people. What is the resistance?
I do think that children raised on the kind of technology that we have, and I mentioned in the book, at Disney World, they have magic bands that you can wear on your hand to get through those long waiting lines. If you give your personal identifying information, Cinderella will greet your child on his or her birthday, because after they go over the magic reader, it has a different name, but it's all made to be fun and friendly. I think with the government not, as I said, doing its job in protecting the most vulnerable people in our society, children who are raised now with advertisements, as I understand it, in some classrooms and, you know, Coca-Cola sponsorships in the cafeteria. One of the issues I was always interested in when I was in graduate school was advertising to children during Saturday mornings, because they would have a cartoon and then a television ad that was animated so the kids couldn't tell the difference. And children develop manual dexterity and the ability to use computers far earlier than they develop the ability to discern between reality and fantasy. And I think that although computers and technology have opened up our lives, I'd like to liken it to the internet, the creators of which wanted this to be to foster more democratic communications, but in many ways we're seeing how it's being turned again to gather our personal data, to watch us, to control us. So I think that we're in a difficult period because so many people have been born along with the rise of technology taking this enormous burst, and the internet obviously has changed the world in ways that we couldn't have foreseen. So I do think consumerism and corporate control has made this more difficult. I do think it is a depressing scenario, but I don't think it's beyond hope. With awareness comes the possibility of change. I think the Snowden disclosures were the most important revelation that we've had in decades. I mean, Daniel Ellsberg from the Pentagon Papers has said that. I think that we have a window of opportunity to recognize where we are, that we have choices. It's not going to be easy, but it's our job to teach everyone else that, you know, I mean, I came to Berkeley. I've only been here a few times, but I see people, you know, wearing jewelry and sort of feel like I'm back in the 60s a little bit. And that was a period when it was, you know, great to protest or to be individual. And now we've been taught to sort of don't shake the boat, don't be a creative, free-thinking person. We have to reclaim our autonomy and our sense of personal creativity. One very frightening development in the Obama administration is a program he has, I can't remember the name of it, but it's basically if you think a fellow government employee might be a whistleblower, you have a duty to turn that person in. What does that do? It stifles creative thought and people thinking outside the box, which is just what we need, especially to come up with ways to protect the country or, you know, fight against this amorphous enemy that we've created. And again, being in a state of perpetual war is something corporations love. And when you have an amorphous enemy, that enables that. So I do think there's been a sea change with the Snowden revelations, and I hope it's just the beginning as more things come out.
I think if we were just left to our non-military, non-imperial lives, we would straighten this out, because people don't like being intruded upon, and they would want to preserve their privacy, and they would pick those products and those cell phones and those carriers that gave them a measure of protection. And I think there would be a number of companies that would recognize that this is in their interest, rather than turning it over. I think what, and I'm, by the way, a big defender of the internet. I edit Truthdig, which I tell people is like I used to edit Ramparts in the old days, and Truthdig is Ramparts on speed. And, you know, our Chris Hedges article today may be read by millions of people around the world without cutting down another tree. And people on the internet can find all sorts of wonderful things, including Tom Paine or Ben Franklin or, you know, people like that. And they can counter lies, and they can find out what Snowden, I mean, whoever even heard of The Guardian, the English paper, and now lots of people know The Guardian. They can read The Guardian, and they can read the interview with Snowden, and the, you know, and so forth. So I think there are a lot of real things. What scares me is what really Washington, again, I've become a big Washington person, despite his contradictions, I'm very well aware of. But there's this whole notion that you can't be both a republic and an empire in the same moment, which is, I think, what drove the founders, that they saw the example not only of Rome, but obviously of France, of England, of Spain, that if you're going to be an empire, you're not going to have a government by the people, for the people. You're not going to have accountability. And the main push of our Constitution was an anti-imperial push. Keep things local, local level, keep them manageable. And so I see that as the main tension. Now, to be optimistic, even the same Obama who was playing the hawk and doing some of these things, and now we see a reversal. And maybe this won't last that long. But we saw an incredible coalition in Congress of Republicans and Democrats voting against getting into another, you know, war in the Middle East and Syria. We see opening to Iran, for example, and a willingness to try diplomacy over war. And I wonder whether the big issue over privacy isn't a fight over empire. Mm-hmm. If you want to have an empire, you have to have secrecy. You have to have militarism. You have to have lying. And that the only way you can preserve democracy is by abandoning that and being a normal country. And what the war on terrorism is all about, really, is an effort to assert the imperatives of empire at a time when they really don't make much sense, when it's not economically, it is for some corporations, but it's not mm-hmm. basically economically viable, costs a lot, human lives and resource. Do you see this as a source of optimism? Did I overstate it?
Well,
I did? Okay, I'm
sorry.
I
think the empire issue is accurate. I do agree that in the last even few weeks, we've seen enormously hopeful.
I should have thrown the Pope in, too.
And the Pope, yeah.
Yeah. Because Ramparts that I did once edit, we started as a Roman Catholic publication with Pope John the 23rd, I think, and now we have a Pope that at least seems to be similar in some ways. No?
I think that...
I know. Right. I'm afraid I'm going to be attacked on Washington also. But, I mean, I'm looking for some marginal signs of improvement here.
I think, again, we have a window of opportunity. I think one of the tasks before us is the sharing of more personal narratives and communicating in communities that we've gotten away from. Let's replace the propaganda of a country that's been so focused on empire, all the mom-and-pop shops that are gone because of Starbucks and other very sterile businesses that want to dictate what kind of coffee we have and what choices we have. The most powerful power that exists is the power of the people. And that's why I'm so proud to work for the National Lawyers Guild, because we've defended protesters and individuals targeted by the government for over 76 years. We ourselves were spied on and infiltrated for four decades by the FBI. We sued them. We got them to admit it. Individual stories are really important to share, and once we lose that, we lose community, which I really think is what empire is fighting against. So I would just encourage people to try to be yourselves, speak out when you get angry, like the fellow in Network did, open your window and shout out, I'm not going to take it anymore. And don't lose sense of who you are and yourself, your creative being.
And a very welcome and positive, affirming note on which to end there. As somebody who has a PhD in artificial intelligence granted to me by a Department of Statistics, I consider myself fairly well qualified to comment on mass processing of data and of interpreting natural language such as emails, and to the best of my knowledge, mass surveillance and collection of data for later use is a very different phenomenon from software-based processing of this collected data. So, without having a large number of analysts to process this data, how could the collection apparatus still be effective at creating conformity by making people change their behavior, making people afraid? That, of course, would necessitate publicizing the data collection. Enter Edward Snowden. Now, having no information either way on the truth or lies of Edward Snowden's stated motivations, I'm reserving judgment, though it is interesting how little independent verification has been carried out, and how, compared to earlier whistleblowers, he's been afforded very different treatment by the commercially controlled media. Now let's hear some thoughts on this from Naomi Wolf, author of End of America.
Right. Well, just for the record, I worked informally with the Clinton campaign. I was advising their advisor, and then I worked formally for the Gore campaign for Gore 2000, working on messaging and policies for women. How did I go? Well, it was partly being inside the belly of the beast that led me to understand maybe more clearly or early, you know, what was happening in terms of the book I wrote, which I think you're referring to, The End of America, which argued that there's a systematic assault that began with Bush but has now carried on and escalated with Obama against our liberties in the United States. I guess when you're inside the belly of the beast, you see how fragile democracy is and how convenient it is for stakeholders and gatekeepers and electeds and incumbents and the people who are funding them, which is six major industries right now in the United States, funding both parties, how convenient it would be for them to just get rid of democracy altogether. You know, they don't want to hear from constituents. They don't want constituents to be organized and empowered. They don't really want democracy to work. And so, because it's really inconvenient to have to win elections rather than just sitting with the six people who fund you and dividing up the pie. And if you're Halliburton or you're, you know, Big Pharma or you're Big War, you don't want the people to have a voice. You just want to sit with your representative and say, okay, start another war because, you know, we need to keep growing that 45%, you know, that the war industry is up, in, you know, in 2014 in America. So I guess I saw also not only how much these powerful entities want to get rid of democracy, I studied closing societies around the world, and I saw that all closing societies or fascist societies or totalitarian societies do exactly the same things to either close down democracy or keep democracy closed and suppress the chance that it would resurface.
In the book, The End of America, you outline those 10 steps that a government takes in order to subvert democracy. I mean, at this point with Obama's presidency nearing an end, what steps have and have not yet been employed? Because when you wrote that book, a lot had already been on its way.
Yeah. I'm sad to say, I say this with no pride, that everything I predicted in that book has more than come true. And it's not that I'm so prescient. It's that once you know how to close an open society, you can predict what's going to happen. So everything, you know, all the 10 steps are being actualized, and they're much further along than I could have even imagined in 2008. I mean, we basically have martial law now because we have the National Defense Authorization Act in 2012, which gives the president the power to seize anyone anywhere at his will or her will and hold them indefinitely without charge or trial. We have a surveillance state, which was step number 4, I believe. And actually we're seeing what's really scary to me, and you have a global audience, this is important, is that we're seeing exactly the same legislation introduced in democracy after democracy to close down people's remaining liberties. We're seeing surveillance bills in New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and Britain. We're seeing new curbs on the free press in, you know, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, Britain. We're seeing the sort of meme of the terrorist. You can do anything to the terrorist, and then dissent becomes, like, if you're a protester, you're a terrorist. You're seeing that in democracies around the world. So this is definitely a blueprint that's now global. You know, we now have a kill list. I mean,